This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
For the first time, U.S. subscribers can stream MLB Network 24/7, including select out-of-market games.
Swing and a drive. It's deep. It's gone. Yes!
Stream minor league affiliates.
Home run number one.
Or draft pick number one.
Plus, get MLB Big Inning and live audio for all 30 teams.
Baseball can't get better than this.
Experience the game like never before with MLB Network and At-Bat, your all-in-one baseball destination. Only $6.99 per month. Visit MLB.com/At-Bat for details. Blackout and other restrictions apply. MLB trademarks used with permission.
Play ball! It's 30 with Murdy with your host, Sweeney Murdy.
Welcome back, everyone. Happy New Year to you all. As the Counting Crows once sang, maybe this year will be better than the last. Here's the first of what I hope are more interesting conversations and topics on this podcast. It's a chat with former big league pitcher Bill Pulsifer, whose career has a lot of relevance to the direction starting pitching has taken in today's game. 25 years ago, as we were getting ready for spring training 1996, both the Yankees and Mets had seeds of optimism. The Yankees had just been to the playoffs for the first time in over a decade, and they would begin the season with their new manager, Joe Torre, and their new shortstop, Derek Jeter. We kind of know what happened to them as they went along. The Mets were coming off a decent finish in 1995, but the excitement for them centered on three young pitching prospects who we were all certain would be cornerstones of a dynasty. In 1995, Bill Pulsifer and Jason Isringhausen rose to the majors with some success and promise, and they were soon to be joined by Paul Wilson, who was chosen by the Mets with the first overall pick out of Florida State in the 1994 draft. The group was marketed as Generation K, a hard-throwing group of young pitchers that was generating buzz not just in New York, but nationally as well. The late 60s and 70s were about Seaver, Kuzman, and Matlack. The 80s were about Gooden, Darling, Fernandez. And the 90s and beyond would surely be about Pulsifer, Wilson, and Isringhausen. But it never happened the way it was supposed to. They all had flashes of brilliance, and Isringhausen went on to have an outstanding career as a closer in later years. But injuries derailed this trio before it ever made its mark. Pulsifer was the first to go down in the spring of 96. He underwent Tommy John, didn't throw a pitch all season. The others would follow in due time. The trio never appeared in the same rotation even once, not a single turn. Injuries happen, of course, but in the cases of Pulsifer, Wilson, and Isringhausen, the staggering number of innings they threw in the minors might be seen as a contributing factor. I say staggering because the care given to modern pitching prospects, the careful monitoring of their innings, is well documented. But a quarter century ago, the idea was still to build up starting pitchers with minor league innings, and the Mets did that with all three pitchers. It was nothing out of the ordinary then, but it seems insane when viewed with today's perspective. Both Pulsifer and Isringhausen averaged over 200 innings per season in 1994-95. And those are seasons in which most major league pitchers didn't reach those numbers because of strike-shortened seasons. And Paul Wilson, in his first full minor league season in 95, threw 186 innings. Did all three pitchers break down because innings limits and pitch counts the way we know them now weren't a thing back then? It's impossible to say for sure, but you could make that case. And high hopes the Mets had in those three prospects crashed in a hurry. Pretty soon throughout baseball, there were pitch counts. There were innings limits. In the case of a Yankees prospect a decade later, there were the famous jobber rules. All of that, you might say, could be traced to the disastrous results the Mets had with their prized prospects that entered 1996 with so much to dream on. Pulsifer never became a star, but he kept pitching. He made his last major league appearance in 2005 and pitched another 6 years in independent leagues, including with the Long Island Ducks. Pulsifer still makes his home on Long Island, and that's where I caught up with him in late December. Here is my conversation with Bill Pulsifer. Every time I get into discussions now or hear discussions about pitch counts, innings limits, it didn't used to be this way, I always kind of think back to you because I always feel like you and the guys you came in with were kind of the tipping point for why pitch counts and innings limits are needed today. And they become such a big part of today's game. Do you feel that way? Do you feel like your career kind of started the shift?
Yeah, I definitely have thought that for a long time. You know, I look back to a couple of things that that I did that I don't think will ever happen again. One is throwing 200 innings in a minor league season. I don't think that'll ever happen again. And also, my first start in the major leagues, I threw 135 pitches.
Yeah.
So I don't think those things are ever going to happen again. Yeah, I think, you know, what happened with us definitely made things a little bit different in the game. But, you know, when we were coming through, there was that thing that was that the pitchers need to have 500 innings. It's kind of like the thing with the at-bats for the hitters and the innings for the pitchers. So at the time, the Mets were kind of, you know, a struggling ball club, and they were looking for some positivity and some hope. And they wanted to get those 500 innings done maybe just to – feel like, you know, the guys were according to their unwritten rules, they were major league ready to come up and be ready to play.
At the time, you didn't think anything unusual of it, right? I mean, I feel like you guys are all competitors and you kind of work under the, you know, whatever parameters you're working in at the time. It didn't seem like it was that unusual. You pitched until you were told not to.
Yeah, we definitely wore it as a badge of honor to get past the seventh into the eighth and ninth innings. That was, you know, you only get to play once every 5 days as a starting pitcher, so you want to get the absolute most out of it that you possibly can. So I wouldn't have had it any different at the time. You know, maybe things looking back could have been done a little bit differently, but I definitely think that the game kind of evolved due to my elbow and Jason Isringhausen's elbow and Paul Wilson's elbow and just but it doesn't seem to matter anyway because the guys are, you know, the rate of Tommy John nowadays is just so high. And so it's just, for me, it's like, it seems like the inevitable. If you throw, you're gonna hurt at some point in time. And with the science the way it is, they'll fix you and hopefully get you back out there.
You hit on a couple of the numbers that I wanted to get to, and obviously they stand out in your mind. In 1994, you're 20 years old. In your Double-A season, you threw 201 innings, including five complete games.
And then two complete games in the playoffs.
Okay, that didn't count in the total. And then the next year, between AAA and the majors, you threw 218 innings. I mean, it just seems like this was built for disaster. Did anybody think that at the time?
No, absolutely not. It was never even talked about. Anything that was, like I said, the only thing I really remember being talked about was getting those 500 innings in the minor leagues done before you were deemed major league ready by the old school standards. So, and that's the thing about when you're a top prospect and that is succeeding, because obviously there's plenty of top prospects that don't do well off the bat, but we were doing so well that a bad outing was still seven innings, three or four runs, and you threw 115 to 120 pitches. You really didn't ever have those outings where you got knocked out in the first or second or third inning and only threw 50 or 60 or 70 pitches on that given week. So I didn't think anything different of it. I just felt like this is what you were supposed to do. You're supposed to go out there and take the ball, and that's my ball, and hopefully I only have to hand it off for a few outs, if any outs at all, just to do what your job was, which was to give the team a chance to win and keep your team in the ballgame.
I had a vague recollection of your big league debut. I was there. I remember being in the group in the clubhouse at Shea Stadium after the game talking to you, but then I looked up the details, and it boggles my mind today, 25 years later. You went seven innings, but you gave up five runs in the first inning.
Incredible.
And you still managed to go seven. You allowed nine hits, seven runs, walked six, struck out three. And as you mentioned, the pitch count in the box score says 131 pitches. In a big league debut, I mean, I would think multiple people would be fired if that happened today.
I don't even think they would even get to that point to where there would definitely be a phone call made and, hey, this guy's out of the game, get him out of the game. And it would be talked about before the game, I would suspect, too. You know, we're not going to let that happen. I mean, I've been out of the game for a while now, but I know people that are involved and some of the younger kids that are around here that are playing in organized ball in the minor leagues. And it seems like they get around 100 innings in the minor leagues, and they're starting to think about shutting them down or resting them. So I think there's a fine line, you know, between getting out there and pitching and learning how to pitch, which I think is different nowadays because of the velocity. It's not as much pitching as it used to be. It's more trying to overpower guys and then just try to put them away with nasty stuff. Where when we weren't throwing that hard, you know, you had to move the ball around a little bit more. You had to do some things, but you know, I was out there to pitch and give me the ball, and I only get to play once every 5 days, so I'm going to throw as many pitches as possible. It wasn't the best idea now looking back on it, but who's to say what would have happened if, you know, maybe I wouldn't have developed if I wasn't out there getting that extra experience.
But you talk about the rate of Tommy John now, too. I seem to think, and I don't have the evidence to back it all up, but the idea that everybody seems to be trying to throw every pitch as hard as they possibly can, which is why you're not throwing 130 pitches. You're probably gassed after about 75 or 80. That seems to have been what's progressed from the time that you broke into now too.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. And you know, with so many guys in the middle to the back end of the bullpens too, with the velocity that they have when they come in now too, it makes it less of an importance to go through that lineup that third or fourth time because you got another guy coming in who's going to be bringing it, you know, in the high 90s and maybe with a little funk to him with his delivery or a wipeout slider type pitch. So, you know, I think that the reliance on the bullpen has become much greater. And a lot of that is because the stuff that the guys are bringing out there on a nightly basis is so much different than it was, you know, when the mid relievers, when I was playing, they didn't quite have the electric stuff that you see nowadays throughout the whole bullpen from the first guy to the last guy, the closer.
What do you remember about your debut? You know, I know there was a lot of anticipation about it because, as you mentioned, the Mets have been struggling, and there was a glimmer of hope with these guys that were coming up and maybe reminding them of, you know, Seaver, Kuzman, and Ryan, and a lot of hype around your minor league starts. I remember we carried one of Jason Isringhausen's minor league starts, or I think the minor league all-star game, on the radio that same year. But you come up, I think it's a Saturday or Sunday afternoon at Shea, and that first inning, you know, I think you walked in a run. It might have seemed like it took forever. What do you remember about that day?
It did. I remember quite a few things. Obviously, they giving up the 5 runs in the first inning, but funny story about that is there was 2 balls hitting the gap, one in right center, one in left center, and both balls could have been caught, might have been caught, but Bugsy, Brett Butler was playing center field, and I didn't see him for, it had to be well over 15 years, and I ran into him in St. Lucie, and this is years ago now, but the first thing he said to me was, man, I still feel bad about not catching those balls in the first inning. So, obviously things could have been different. I was nervous as hell. You know, my knees were knocking, and this is something that I had been anticipating my whole life, which was, you know, I only tried to do one thing in my life up to that period, and that was become a Major League Baseball player. So, it was a very special moment. And then to give up 5 runs in the, I remember my first pitch to Todd Hundley, cut about 3 feet. And went to the backstop. So that was my first pitch in the major league. It was kind of like a Fauci pitch, but not quite as not quite. But you know what? I left out, and I remember saying after the game, I left out of that game feeling like a victory, even though it was a loss. Simply because to be able to give up 5 runs in the first inning, and then still to be able to walk off the mound after getting your last out, as opposed to somebody coming and taking the ball from you, I wore that as a badge of honor. And even though I didn't win the game, and it took me a couple of more starts before I finally did get my first win, I felt like I had accomplished something there. And I always remember walking out, I want to say it was the fourth or fifth inning, and the theme song from Friends was playing. I was walking out to pitch, to throw my warm-up pitches, and I found myself singing the song. And that's when I kind of felt like, all right, I'm here. This is just a baseball game, and we can go on from here. So I definitely remember that day. Obviously, for the pitches thrown, the five runs in the first inning, and then just finally realizing my dream. I grew up a Mets fan, so to walk out in the Big Blue Stadium and just to be part of it all was it was the day before Father's Day, so I'll always remember that as well. Special. You don't get those. Those are once in a lifetime moments.
Your next start, I had to look this one up because I'd forgotten. I mean, that's 14 hits, right?
Yeah.
And 14 hits. Nobody does that anymore.
I remember being on the plane. We were flying from New York to Miami. I want to say it was because I pitched. That's when I finally got my first win. It was the third start. And Jay Horowitz coming to me on the plane and trying to tell me don't feel so bad because there was a pretty good pitcher that gave up more than 14 hits, and that was Tom Seaver. So, while I didn't quite set the record that day, I was vying for it.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's a pretty rough indoctrination, especially when, as you know, and I'm sure you're probably, it wasn't the same with social media, but you were probably pretty aware of what your status was as a prospect in the organization and what kind of hopes the team was putting around, not just you, but the group that you were coming up with. There were a lot of people relying on you, and to have a couple of clunkers out of the gate, I know you felt pretty good about the first one, but I mean, that had to, was it eating at your confidence at all, or were you just kind of knowing that it was just your first two starts?
Well, you know, I mean, I came up in the time watching like the Braves guys when they were turning into the Hall of Famers that they were. And I remember their, if you look at their records, their first few years in the major leagues, they weren't great. You know, they had way upside down records, and it was kind of one of those things where that was kind of to be expected in a way a little bit when, I mean, there's guys like Dwight Gooden that did it a little bit differently, but it was kind of talked about a little bit to where don't expect to come up here and right away just to start winning ball games and doing the same things that you did in the minor leagues. But obviously, when you give up as many runs and as many hits as I did my first two starts, it does wear on you a little bit. But I do remember Brett Saberhagen telling me right before my third start, hey, don't be afraid to do something down in Miami. And me and Don Franco ended up throwing a combined shutout, and I got to strike out, you know, guys that I grew up watching, Hall of Famer like Andre Dawson and you know, Terry Pendleton and doing – and it's crazy because I had watched this a couple of years ago. I did something with Newsday, and my son, me and my oldest son, sat and watched that game, actually, a recording of that game. And I told my son that I strictly went on my scouting report from watching guys like Pendleton and the Hawk, watching those guys growing up and using what I saw was able to get them out when I was growing up. I used that exact same stuff in the game and for it to actually work. So it was kind of one of those things then, like, all right, couple of bad starts, but now I'm starting to get into the groove of this a little bit. And as it turns out, you know, I think I even set a record for most consecutive starts of seven innings or in a row to start his career. I know it's something like that. Something crazy like that too.
Now, it's not just you, and I mean, you're always lumped in with Jason Isringhausen, Paul Wilson. The innings numbers for them really stand out to me too. Same year that you were in Double A, Jason Isringhausen is throwing 193 innings. He's only a year older. He's 21, 8 complete games. The next year, when you hit 218 innings and reach the majors, Isringhausen reaches the majors, throws a total of 221 innings. And that same year, Paul Wilson's knocking on the door. He's a college pitcher, so a little bit different, but he threw 186 innings. I mean, I just can't wrap my head around those numbers anymore. And I was there in that era with you, knowing what it was, but it just seems to me, Pulse, we're so far removed from that, that those numbers don't even seem like it's from a different time. It just seems like it's not even possible to do.
Right. I think if you were to say that to some of the younger front office guys that are involved in baseball now, you would blow their minds that ever even happened. You know, I always go back to this as well because I look at those kinds of numbers trying to rationalize and come up with what all really went down. And I look back at and I hear that Nolan Ryan didn't throw 200 innings for the first time until he was 25 years old.
Yeah.
So, You know, I don't know if it was they didn't know any better, we didn't know any better, or if it was just, you know, I in a way, and so this sounds silly, but I kind of thought I was like Superman. You know, I was going to be able to do things that nobody else could do. And up to a certain point, it kind of was that. So I unfortunately had to humbly find out that I'm not Superman, and I'm you know, just a mere mortal and can get hurt and go through all kinds of stuff that can tear you down and wear you down. But, you know, I wear those as a badge of honor too. I did it, you know, I did it, and they don't ask the kids to do that nowadays. And, you know, not a lot of people could have went out there and done it, but I take it as, hey man, I was out there and I was throwing that ball and I was taking that ball and you weren't going to take it away from me.
Spring of 96, you never made it to the starting gate. You got hurt, Tommy John. What do you remember about how that kind of developed, what your off season was like, and how you kind of went into that spring before knowing that you needed Tommy John?
Well, it started in Montreal at the end of the year with about 2 weeks to go. I had started against Pedro up in Montreal. Well, I want to say it was the first game of the series. So the third game of the series was my bullpen day. And I remember throwing my bullpen and just feeling something's not right in my elbow. It just feels a little weak. It doesn't feel stable. So we right away went back to New York and got an MRI. And I was told a sprain in the ligament. And that's when I left there and talked to my agent, Craig Finnick, and he explained to me what the sprain of the ligament meant, is that that's the ulnar collateral ligament. Because I didn't even know. I just figured, man, I sprained my ankle a million times.
Right.
It's a big deal. I'll be fine in a little while, and I'll get back out there. But I was prescribed rehab for 8 weeks, and I lived in St. Lucie at the time. So in the wintertime, I would take, you know, a month off, 3 weeks off, and then get right back up to the minor league complex. And I was there 6 days a week. So that's what I was doing with the training staff up there. And I just remember it never really, even though they said, all right, you know, you'll be all right, you'll be fine. I just remember it never really feeling good. It just didn't feel like it felt before. Like it still just felt like a weakness in that. And then we started spring training and I was able to pitch the first couple games. And I remember there was a night game being televised back up in New York. And I remember warming up in the bullpen and thinking to myself, man, I've never thrown this hard before in my life. Yeah. And it was kind of like, I guess an engine running really prime right before it was about to explode, because, about the second or third inning, I remember throwing a curveball to end the inning and walking off and looking over at John Franco, who was sitting in the dugout and just giving him the finger across the hand across the throat saying, that's it. That's it. So, you know, and then some things happened that weren't the best where, you know, you go, you get your MRI and you get told, well, there's too much inflammation. We can't really tell. And then Mark Clark gets traded for the following day. And then you're told you're going to have Tommy John. So I think that they kind of probably knew that it wasn't going to be good news when the swelling did go down. And unfortunately it wasn't.
The idea of Tommy John today, it's still very serious. It's still an injury that takes time to recover. They haven't sped up the timetable a lot, but there is a particular success rate that makes people feel like it's not very serious. You were still getting it at a time where it wasn't necessarily, oh, I'll come back from this, right? I mean, it was a pretty big deal at the time.
Yeah, I mean, look, I came back, but I, to be honest, I never threw quite the way that I did prior. I was close. And then obviously a lot of other things crept in after that with anxiety and depression and that, because not ever knowing how to deal with negatives, because nothing had ever been really negative in my life other than my parents divorcing. And in the baseball field was always my solemn place anyway, where I could go and be away from everything else. So, you know, I never threw the same. I know that you look at Izzy was a 92, 93 guy. He had his first or second Tommy John and came back and he was 96, 98 when he went to Oakland. So, and I lost my curveball. My curveball was never the same. But, you know, I don't know how much of that had to do with some of the mental stuff going on as well. But I just felt like my stuff was never quite the same after I had Tommy John.
I don't know how much you've thought about this particular element of it, but when you mentioned the battles you had with depression and anxiety, how much of that was, do you know or think, was kind of lingering inside you? How much was brought on by the injury and the things that then kind of dominoes fell in your career? Have you been able to kind of figure out where that all falls in relation to what happened to your career?
Well, I come to find out later on in life to find out that, you know, how on my mother's side that anxiety and depression kind of run in the family a little bit. So it's something I didn't know as a younger man. I think back, and I always bring this up, I think back to the free throw line in high school, and remembering how I felt standing at the free throw line in high school, where everything else kind of felt normal, and just something about the free throw line. I remember feeling those same feelings that I would feel when I'd be standing on the mound once it did start to happen, which was just uncontrollable. You know, I couldn't control the butterflies in the stomach, or just the apprehension and the anxiety. Basically, you know, that's the word to describe it. Is that's kind of when it started. But it never really festered itself and came out until after I got injured. And a lot of it, man, I went through such a great rehab, even though I wasn't throwing the same stuff. I got told, well, you didn't play for a year, so there's no way that you can come back and come right back to the major league level because you didn't play for a year. And I know I was just a rookie the year before, but I also grew up in a time where you don't lose your job to injury. That's what I was always heard, because I was a huge sports fan growing up for all the sports. And that was one of those kinds of those things that you hear through all sports, where you don't lose your job due to injury. When you're healthy, you got your job back. Well, the way I looked at it was, I was one of the starting five for the New York Mets who happened to get hurt. I came back and, all right, my stuff's not as good as it was. And I went through all through spring training that year of 97 fine. I wasn't throwing the same stuff, but I was fine. I was getting outs. I threw 30 something innings in spring training, which that doesn't happen anymore either. And something about my first start, they sent me on a rehab assignment to AAA and starting in Syracuse. It might have been the first game of the year. I don't even know. But something just wasn't right. And I was sitting on the trainer's table getting my arm massaged out because it was freaking 30-something degrees up there that night. And just didn't feel right, man. Sweating. It's cold. I'm sweating profusely from my underarms and my hands. And this is something I'd never really felt before, other than maybe the first or second hitter of a game. And then once you get those first or second hitters out of the way and you're into the game and it's gone and you're out there competing. It did turn into where it was every single pitch from before I even pitched, like the night before, couldn't sleep, couldn't, you know, it's just, I don't wish it on anybody. I really don't. I wish everybody could feel it so you could have that understanding as to what it is. But then I wish it would go away and nobody would ever have to feel that, because it's terrible to try to perform, especially perform it, you know, at a 1%er level. It's impossible. There's just no way that you're going to succeed.
How do you manage it today?
I don't pitch.
Pretty much it, huh? It's gotten a lot easier.
Yeah, I don't pitch. No, you know what? But I tell you what, how do I manage it? I try to be aware of it when it is coming on, and knowing that like I said, I don't have to pitch. But obviously, my oldest son is a pitcher. My youngest son is a position player. One in college, one in high school. And I feel it then. I do feel it then. And I just am helpful and I'm grateful that I don't have to be out there actually trying to get it done. Cause I know that's what I would be feeling, but I took medication all the way. I pitched till I was 37. I was playing an independent baseball. I pitched till I was 37 and I used to call it strike throwing pills. I know it sounds silly, whatever, but it is what it is. I needed it. And I remember even like up to the end of my career, I would, on the day that I would pitch, I would stay in bed till 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I would stay up late, late, and then stay in bed because I didn't want to be awake for hours and hours and hours before, because I know that I would be dwelling and feeling the anxiety. I just wanted to get up, go to the yard, get myself ready and go pitch, because, and that was all the way till I was 37 years old. So it's, it was, while it was my love of my life, it was also, you know, be careful what you wish for.
Just like we've come a long way in examining the workload, I think, as you know, in society, we've come a long way in understanding things like depression and anxiety and different mental difficulties that people go through. Do you look back on it now, when you combine those two things that greatly impacted your career and are looked at in a much different way now, I mean, do you think that things could have turned out differently? Do you think that there's blame to go around? Do you think it's just kind of what happened? How do you look at that?
I definitely don't look to blame at all. You know, it is what it is. Like I said earlier, I wouldn't have had it any different. This is what I wanted to do. This is the way I wanted to do it. You want to be known as the guy that was going out there and taking the ball to the end of the game. I think that a lot of young guys, while I'm not asking for thanks, they could say thanks in a way. I say this all the time. I feel like I was way ahead of my time, and not just in good things, but in bad things as well, because I had the crazy outward personality that they're allowing in the game nowadays, where the guys, I mean, I look at Pete Alonso's shoes. He's got a different pair of cleats on every single night. The belts don't match. And I know I'm old now. I know I'm old. Because that stuff's starting to bother me a little bit. I was that guy, you know, I was that guy way ahead of my time when it comes to that kind of stuff, with the trying to be flashy and trying to have my own personality outward of the team, but still within the team framework. And that rubbed a lot of the older guys wrong. And I look back and shit, I wish I would have handled things a little bit differently. But same thing with the mental thing. Like, you know, these are things that you didn't want to even bring up or at all back then. And now I don't think any team probably goes anywhere without their sports psychologist or team psychologist with them. I don't think anybody goes anywhere without that.
Yeah.
And I know they put in the clubhouses now, they have the decompression chambers and all this kind of stuff that, you know, might've been helpful for me years ago.
I look at how quickly things changed after the three of you guys got hurt in pretty rapid succession in 1996, right around there. Roy Halladay in 1997 was pitching in AA and AAA at age 20. He threw 162 innings. And a couple of years after, I'm looking at guys who had strong workloads in the
right.
in the years after that. Mark Burley, who I think you play with for a short while, really durable for a very long time. In 2000, he was 21 years old and pitched a total of 170 innings. So, I mean, you guys don't have any awards named after you, but you clearly left an impression on everybody to let them know this really isn't how you treat 20 and 21-year-old arms.
Yeah, I've always said that my elbow is pretty much a guinea pig as to, you know, how things were going to be changed in the sport. So you look, while I didn't have the career that I would have wanted and that a lot of Mets fans would have wanted and a lot of fans of the teams that I played would have wanted, I definitely have a mark on the game that I think is going to – I don't want to use big words like everlasting, but it definitely – my experience definitely changed the game, absolutely.
I remember when the Yankees were bringing up their group in the spring of 2008, Phil Hughes, Jabba Chamberlain, Ian Kennedy.
There was no Jabba rules without my elbow.
Right. And the conversation automatically came right to you, as it usually does when you have a group of two or three starting pitchers, especially in New York. But the Jabba rules obviously went into effect in 2007. They were around in 2008 again. And I remember doing like a deep dive comparison to the innings that those guys threw and that you guys threw. And I posted it online on the FAN website. And I got an email from it had one line. It said, "The Mets ruined my husband's career." And it says it came from your wife. I never verified that it was her.
If she did, but I'm not saying she didn't, I'm not aware.
I never verified it was her or not, but that's always stuck in my head, because you guys did have to go through and lose something. You had to lose something in order for other people to gain something.
Yeah, it was, you know, that's why I say I have an indelible mark on the game for sure. Whether it be a positive, a negative, or whatever, there's a mark left by what I went through and what, you know, Izzy and Paul went through. Obviously, Izzy went on. Shit, he saved over 300 games in the major leagues, had a great career. But I was the first guy. I was the first guy to come up there and, you know, to wear that badge. You know, I don't begrudge anybody, you know, and I'd love to. I was lucky enough to go to Mets Fantasy Camp this past year for the first time and put the uniform on again. And I'm still, you know, I'm a Met till the day I die, the way I look at it. And I'm a Mets fan till the day I die as well, too.
Your oldest son, Liam, pitches at Stony Brook. Is that correct?
No, he's at Queens College now.
Okay. Yeah. But he's a pitcher.
Yes.
What kind of care do you hope he gets, or what kind of advice do you pass on to him or the people that are coaching him?
Well, obviously, throughout his younger career and his high school career, we I made sure that he wasn't overused, you know, and I think that for the most part, the coaches that he was involved with in his high school coach was a former professional as well. He played very little, played a year or two in A-ball, Dennis Donovan. He had an understanding as well. And then they implemented the 105 pitch rule when my son got into high school. So they're not allowed to throw more than 105 pitches. I mean, I remember being an American Legion ball when I was in high school and throwing, and we played 9-inning games, not 7-inning games, and throwing 140 pitches once a week, you know, on the weekends.
Yeah.
So, you know, you hope that that's the thing about when, once you send your kid to college, they, college coaches don't want to have anything to do with the parents for the most part. But fortunately the guy, the coach Reardon at Queens is a former left-handed pitcher as well. So, and the way that they're looking at it for Liam is to be a weekend pitcher, and on the weekend is where they play their doubleheader game. So that would mean it would be 2 sevens as opposed to a 9-inning game, like a midweek game. So, you know, you hope for the best. He's been looked after. You know, he threw today to live hitters, to hitters indoors, actually. And, you know, we just – I try to let him understand what I went through and how I was treated and how I treated myself when it came to those kinds of things, and just to – look, is he going to play in the professional baseball? Who knows? He doesn't have the velocity right now, especially with the way the game is. But he's definitely going to be pitching for the next 3 years at least. So knock on wood, hopefully he remains healthy. He did have a little bit of a tenderness in his elbow a year or so ago, but that seems to have subsided. And we've just been generally not – I don't want to say super cautious, but cautious enough to know that we're, look, we're not going to go out and throw 130 pitches. I don't care what the situation is.
And you've been doing over the years, you've done some coaching or lessons locally in Long Island, right?
Yeah.
What do you tell the kids? What do you tell the parents?
I tell them, this is kind of one of those things. We can start with something simple as like when to start throwing the breaking ball. I actually believe in starting to throw the breaking ball at 11 or 12 years old, teaching them how to do it. Then I tell them it's up to you as the parent, you as the player, and then to have the discussion with your coach, because at the travel ball level and that, the coaches are usually calling the game for the most part, to let them know that we're allowed to throw 5 of these today. We're allowed to throw 4 of these today. And then, because what I've seen with the younger guys that turn 13, 14, going into 15, and that's when they say, all right, I want to start learning a breaking ball. Man, they have the hardest time learning how to do it. So it's kind of one of those things where they say, you know, the breaking ball is bad for the elbow. But I feel like you got to learn how to do it. You got to learn how to throw on the side of the baseball a little bit as opposed to on top and behind the baseball. To learn how to do it, because if you get to that age where you've been started pitching at 7 or 8 years old and you pitch till you're 13 or 14, you're not going to have that breaking ball. And everybody always says, well, we want to save his arm. But then my response to that, Neil Heaton, who I work with up at 365 Athletics in Bellport, we say the same thing. You're saving it for what? Because if you don't have a breaking ball, chances are you're going to get beat around. So I like to try to tell the people you need to learn it early, but then we're going to keep a leash on it, as opposed to when I learned it early and then it became, all right, 2 strikes, we're throwing a curveball in there, we're going to make them swing and miss and make them look silly. You know, I tell everybody, be wary of your coach, you know, be willing to step up, because there is a team. There's so many teams out there. There's so many travel ball organizations out there. You can find one, and if you're not happy there, you can find another one. If you feel like the coach is abusing your son or using your son too much, but I just feel like you got to take it by control and say, we're not going to do certain things, but you also have to be out there enough to be able to develop and learn how to pitch your way through some tough situations, get out of jams, because if you're going to continue to move forward, you're going to have to be able to pitch in tough situations as well, but hopefully not in the 7th inning, after you've already thrown 85 pitches, that's when we're going to have you with the bases loaded and we need to get this out.
You know, you touch on something, Pulse, that I don't know how you teach it today, but if you're pitching in a big league game and let's just say you're probably on this rough count of 90 to 100, right? Well, if you're in the 5th or 6th inning of a game, you've got 2 men on and it's a 1-run ball game, the most important pitches you throw are going to be the next 5, the next 10, which would be your last 5, your last 10. And to try to figure out how to dig deep and get there, if you're not allowed to do it, leading up to it, how do you learn how to do it?
I agree 100%. That's where there's that fine line between getting the experience to get yourself out of jams or to get that out when you need to get that out, and knowing that, oh, you know what, I can cave in here and somebody else will come in and clean up my mess, hopefully. And then if it doesn't work out, I can say, well, they didn't do their job, you know. And that's kind of where things were different in my day, where I don't want somebody to come in and try to clean up my mess, because I don't want those runs coming in, because that goes on my mess anyway. And I remember in 1999, I believe it was, I had 20 something inherited runners, and every single one of them came around. And that's an ERA killer, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But no, I agree. You know, that's the problem in this day and age with the showcase mentality for a lot of the younger players coming up, is go out there and light up the gun real quick and have some big school chase you or a pro team chase you, but you've really never been through the battles and what it's like to grind it out, you know? So it's, if you're going to play on a team where, all right, you're going to throw two or three innings, and then he's going to throw two or three innings, and then you don't ever really get in that situation of trying to pitch yourself for, like you said, those next five pitches are going to be the make or break of this ball game, and to learn how to be that guy that can make those five pitches to get the team that out, or get the team back into the dugout, or to hold that lead, or to hold the game where it's at. You don't learn how to do that, you know, and that's obviously very important.
One of the stories that comes out every, you know, a couple of times every year is about the number of high school kids that are getting Tommy John because of how they're used, or even requesting it, wanting it, because they have this belief that it's going to make them better. They're going to come out throwing harder, and they get it behind them, and they don't have to worry about it anymore. Have you dealt with any of those types of things as you see or work with young kids out in Long Island?
No, I haven't ran into anybody that's wanted to have Tommy John. I have worked with two kids that have had Tommy John that were in high school. And I guess they have a new procedure as well, which isn't the full replacement now, but they're actually sewing in some form of a silicone sinews to tie it together again as well. I'm sure that's for ligaments that aren't completely ruptured. I've been around kids that have had the injections, mm-hmm. due to the plasma injections due to a sprain of the UCL. I would never recommend anybody to say, hey, I want to go have Tommy John. You know, I would never say, if your arm's fine, let's leave it. I would say that if you're a guy that's battling for 2 or 3 years and you've had elbow issues and it is the ligament, I would say that maybe you do think about having it. But I would never say, you know what, let's do it just to get it out of the way. I mean, you look at the guy Fairbanks, who was pitching in a World Series this year. He's had it 3 times.
Yeah.
So, and granted, his arm action is crazy. And I don't know how he can throw the ball 100 miles an hour like that, but obviously it's also detrimental to the health of his arm, as he's had Tommy John 3 times. But it just seems like if you throw in the way that they teach the velocity now, we didn't force our velocity,
yeah,
when we were back then. We didn't try to throw. Makes gains. It's just that you threw hard or you didn't throw hard. And now that doesn't mean we weren't out there trying to whip it in there as hard as we could, because I was I was a max effort type of guy. I was trying to throw it as hard as I could. And I still, to my last day, consider myself a power pitcher, even though it didn't come out as fast. I threw it as hard as I threw it with all the power I had.
Well,
you know, where I feel like I watched Jamie Moyer at the end of his career, and he never looked like he was ever trying to throw anything hard.
So go ahead. You mentioned Fairbanks, and it reminds me of, you know, this year's World Series. When you see it go to the extreme, that Blake Snell comes out of a game after 73 pitches, and not just a game in May or June. This is a World Series. Right. You know, do you think that that what happens in the game now, because it started 25 years ago with what happened to you, do you think it's gone too far, or do you kind of shake your head understanding, knowing what they're trying to solve?
I just think that you can't, and what do I know? I'm just some guy. I'm not even involved anymore. But I don't think you can win a World Series using the same bullpen guys night in and night out throughout a playoff, especially with the added rounds of playoffs. You just can't do it. You can't, because the hitters are going to see the guy too many times, and there's only so many times you can get that thing cranked up in a one-run ball game, and I need to get this freaking out. I have to get this out. And I'm not going to be able to get it out by pitching like Greg Maddux. I'm going to have to get him out by overpowering this guy. And I just don't see how it works. So I think that it comes back down to, and 2 years ago proved it, starting pitching. This year, again, in a way, starting pitching. Your starters are going to have to get you deeper into the ballgame because we can't use these guys every single night because they're going to be out of gas come game four, game five, game six of the World Series. They're going to be out of gas. And your best guy is going to end up giving up runs or giving up a lead when you know that he's the best guy out there. He just doesn't have his best stuff anymore. He's cashed. He's done.
So I got two more things for you. One, is there any form that you still keep in touch with Izzy and Wilson? Is there a group text with you guys? Do you have framed Generation K newspaper clippings and posters in your house?
No.
Any of that?
I don't. I do not. I have the stuff. I don't have it anywhere out and about. I do have a baseball card of myself on that I just recently put on my refrigerator, and that's basically the only thing. And then one more thing. This goes back to I have not spoken to Wilson in many, many years. Me and Izzy, not this summer, the summer before, because this summer was canceled pretty much. We were actually inducted into Izzy had a hell of a week because he got two Hall of Fames. One was the Binghamton their baseball shrine, and the other one was the Cardinals Hall of Fame. So he had a big week. I only had a half of a big week when I got put into the Binghamton Hall, their baseball shrine. That's what they call it up there.
That's great.
So we got to see each other again, and we talked through text here and there. I hadn't seen him in a while. I hadn't seen him since 2011 until last year, and then I'm hoping when we get fantasy camp back going again, I'd like to try to get Izzy come down to fantasy camp as well because, you know, it's funny. There was 120 campers down there, and I felt like – and I've always felt like I've received pretty well by Mets fans.
Mm-hmm.
There was only a few guys that kind of felt like they would want to walk the other direction, still disgruntled about Generation K. But, yeah, I still talk to Izzy here and there. Wilson, I haven't spoke to him in years and years. He's kind of wanted to stick to himself for the most part.
I lied. There's one more thing. Do you cringe when you hear Generation K? We just hear people throw that out there and bring it up.
No, man, I'm proud of it.
Yeah.
I'm proud of it. I'm not, you know, it's not what I wanted it to be. It's not what anybody wanted it to be. But I lived it, and I was part of it, and you can't take that away from me. You know, to say you're a one percenter, not a lot of people can say that. Yeah. So take that as that's pride. I know how – and now that I've gone through and I've coached younger kids and I've been in the travel ball scene, and I see how many people play baseball. To know that you even put that baseball uniform on in the major leagues for one day, that says something. Because I see how many kids play and how many kids want to live that dream. So I wear it as a badge. That's a badge of honor, man. I was – whatever. You can say whatever you want about it. That's fine. I lived it. I was out there, and I did it.
You may have just answered my last question. I wanted to simply just ask you, what do you think was your highlight? What makes you smile when you think about your career?
You know, there's not one thing. There's really not one thing. I mean, honestly, we talked about the first start, how I gave up 7 runs, but I can look back and smile on that. Because
yeah.
Like I said, I walked off the mound getting the 3rd out in the 7th inning. I walked off the mound. I didn't have Dallas come and take the ball from me.
Yeah.
Being able to throw a no-hitter in the double-A championship series, you know, first time that had been done since the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Winning a championship in Latin America, in Puerto Rico, going to the Caribbean World Series for 3 years. Just numerous things, man. I can't say one thing. I can name a lot of lows as well. You know, being in Japan and pitching terrible against the Yokohama Giants when we went to go the 2000 series against the Cubs and the Mets over there and feeling like the walls are closing in on me. You know, there's so many stories. I can't think of just one.
My thanks to Bill Pulsifer. He and his Generation K brothers combined to pitch in almost 1,600 professional games. And Isringhausen had the most successful career, notching 300 career saves and making 2 All-Star teams. Their combined records as pitchers for the Mets, however, was just 31-45. If you're new here, please check out the 30 with Murdy archive at radio.com and Apple Podcasts. A lot of fun conversations in 2020, including Rays owners Stu Sternberg, Peter King, Joe Torre, Bobby Richardson, and many more. Please make sure to subscribe and review and all that jazz. Please stay safe and stay well. And until next time, I'm Sweeney Murdy. Thanks for listening.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
In the fast-paced world of attacking, speed is everything. And that's where the Furon 7 Plus shines. Engineered for accuracy and precision at a rapid pace, it's your secret weapon on the pitch. Experience overall comfort and precise striking, even in the game's fastest moments. The nylon outsole, with its V-shaped stud configuration, is designed for firm ground, giving you the grip you need to outmaneuver your opponents. Step up your attacking game and learn more and purchase the Furon at NewBalance.com.
It's a good thing baseballs already have stitches, because the way these ball players are hitting them, yeah, they'd need stitches if they didn't already have them. So the next time you're watching a poor little baseball smacked off the wall in center, keep that little fella in your thoughts. It's hard to be a baseball right now. Baseball is something else. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.